Mark, I'm intrigued about the city seminary, and you painted a picture of 5% Anglo. Can you describe who are the seminarians and where are they coming from and what are they teaching you?
So our seminary draws students from all across the city, all five boroughs, from the student body background would be Pentecostal, Episcopal, Presbyterian, Reformed, Methodist, Baptist, Independent. It would be everybody. It's a bit like a New York subway card. You know, there's not one single group that dominates the group. It's a very diverse group. The faculty, almost everyone, every faculty member is a graduate of our programs. Everyone had to come in, go through our program first, one version. But our key faculty, our key leadership, all were in the first group of students that we had. Maria, who is the dean, was one of our first students. Her and her husband, Tony, came through together. And Maria and her Maria's story is and I learned from Maria every day. Maria is the dean of the seminary. She grew up in Overseas Chinese Mission. Her parents, she grew up in London and China and New York. She has been part of that community, raised in that community, and she is now, after graduating from her parents, she went to get a doctorate at Teachers College, Columbia Teachers College, in adult education, and wrote on women in theological leadership in Africa, Asia, and North America. And Marie is our dean, and she is building our seminary in a way where we're even more intentional about learning together. And so Pray and Break Bread, the youth seminary, the different forms of learning that we have. We have a gallery in our neighborhood that's a place for conversation, which is a wonderful place where people it's like right on the street, and everyone comes in and we have conversations around the neighborhood. So I think there's not a day we're not learning together. I mean, it's not a trite thing to say that every faculty member, who really, of course, has always been a student and part of this, is also a student. Every student is a teacher. Because I don't have the expertise. None of us do. But the experience and expertise is around our table and around our community. And we're learning about youth. We're learning about the city. We're learning about changes, about work. So I think from the most basic to the most complex, the seminary is being shaped by the community. It really is the case that is happening. So, it's really a gift. I've not worked with, I can't imagine the community of people that I'm with any other way than through the way that God wove our stories together. It's really significant and profound.
So it's a totally different model of seminary. I mean, a seminary as a community of learners, and everybody's in the community, and it's a seminary of where everybody has insight and gifts to bring to the table, and well, the professors have a certain kind of a role in guiding that. It's just taking much, much more seriously. That your student is your teacher.
Yeah. But a student may be a bishop, by the way. A student could be a bishop, could be a doctor, it could be any level of church life or any sphere of vocation. We really do have bishops. We really have medical doctors. We also have people that are not, might be building supers. So it's a spectrum.
I'm just wondering about what your experience has been in just gathering together and creating this new church, this new global church, with these cultures that are coming in. I have very limited experience, but I've been in some African churches. They were full of the Spirit. There were miracles that I witnessed, and there was incredible joy and all kinds of really good things. There was also some real more misogynistic thinking, and there was some real top-down. I was in a service near Kibera with probably 3,000, 4,000 people. Some of the poorest people had made their way there, and then there's like six men in suits on the on the stage. And how do you integrate all of that part of culture into what you've got going here?
So that's a very interesting observation. You know, are the congregations from Africa, you know, from different congregations, are they hierarchical? Do they, is there gender discrimination? So I think most churches have a problem with gender. I don't think it's any particular culture has a corner on this problem or this challenge. In my, of the three congregations I focused on, one was led by Mother Cooper, who was a person who brought a movement called the Church of Lord Aladura to North America. And so she led that church and didn't mess with Mother Cooper. And in the Redeemed Christian Church of God, when the pastor I knew transitioned, a woman replaced him. So I think there is a lot more going on in terms of how congregations are working with us. I think gender roles in Pentecostal churches are more complex than maybe they might appear. Sometimes, denominations may have the statement of what they believe and what they're going to do, but they may not live it out. And other places may have a different statement, but live it out very differently. I think something has to be observed on the ground. In terms of being hierarchical, the most hierarchical denomination, one of the movements perceived to be most hierarchical, run very strongly from the top. My understanding of its growth is because it's decentralized. The reason that Pentecostal communities have flourished and are blossoming right and left is because they're decentralized. The authority is rooted on the ground in the pastor, in the community. And so that's why things can happen quickly. If you have to go through a board meeting, like in my denomination, if I want to start a new congregation right now, officially, it could take me a year to get that on the docket. If I'm in a Pentecostal church, next Sunday, I can send out 10 members with 10 chairs, and they can start a new church. You tell me what church is going to grow more. It's going to have more church plants. So I think decentralization, hierarchicalism maybe works itself out in different ways in terms of leadership. And I think in terms of gender roles, I think the entire church is still in a place of learning.
Yes. Have Richard do one more question. And Angela will ask a question. Go, Richard. It's really interesting, the January issue of the Anglican, for those of you who are Anglicans, the front page had a picture of the new bishops and the leadership of the Anglican Church of this diocese. And on one level, you could look at that picture and you say, there's some lovely diversity there. There's our first gay bishop. There's a Métis bishop. There's male. There's female. And you take a look amongst the bishops and apart from Peter Fenty, and then you look amongst the others and you think, it's pretty white. Then you open up the middle page to see the lay people who got the order of the Diocese of Toronto. You open it up and take a look. It's pretty white. Just saying. Richard. So Richard and then Angela, and then we're going to call it a night.
Thank you. I enjoyed your talk last night as well, so I just wanted to come back to something you said about you said it again tonight, the seminary being shaped by the community. That's a fairly postmodern notion. Now all things are perspectival and all perspectives matter. The notion of anthropology fieldwork that you were alluding to, that sense of going out and sensing is a kind of Victorian notion. Phenomenology is the overarching principle that you just experience a phenomenon and observe it and make your notes. So I'm wondering if it's fair to say that within your work you are flagging that all of these tools are available and we should just pull from wherever we find them, all things working together for good for those who love the Lord. The other thing that I wanted to say is one of our Anglican beloved, Archbishop Tutu, famously and quite controversially said that the receiving of the gospel, I mean, we think of colonialism and the Christian church as the sort of tip of the spear of colonialism, the receiving of the gospel was worth it. And so your image of the gospel moving around the world and coming back in those Nigerian churches kind of picks that up. So the African context, the context of the African Anglican Christian in Archbishop Tutu's comment is it was worth it, which is pretty controversial and pretty challenging to our sort of our ideas of the principalities and powers as colonialism. And so I just wanted to bring those into the mix. And then embodiment, the embodiment you describe reminded me of the embodiment described by Carthusian monks battling in their cells. So within the Christian tradition, the ancient Christian tradition, we have people engaging in spiritual battles in their cells, and there's, you know, it's it may seem like exoticizing, but we have these kinds of practices in our Christian tradition that produce similar kinds of embodiment.
Thank you.
I'm so glad Richard asked that question. So you got to know, some of these are my peeps. So Julia, who put the question about exoticization at the beginning, was one of the first students I had in my campus ministry. Richard has been one of my students. This is stuff I have to answer, so it's your turn.
So let us close in prayer.
I know. And Angela's got a question too in a second.
Okay, so this is percolating. I hear it. Thank you, Brian. Take responsibility for it. So here's a couple of things. I wouldn't say exactly. I hear what you're saying about Tutu. I know he said something similar about the Bible and prayer, but I'm not quite sure he said it like that, but he might have. Right. So, and I wish he was healthier right now and able to provide that voice. First of all, I would say, I think when was it? I talked about early Syria. I think it was early somewhere today, in the last couple of days. I talked about the roots of Christian faith in Africa or in Antony in the 3rd and 4th century, St. Antony, and fighting the demons in the desert and then doing the pastoral work back in town. So I think there's a strong, if you look at the history of African Christianity, I don't think contemporary movements have a long history. And so I don't think when we talk about fighting demons and so on, it's new, certainly not from the first century, and certainly that was early Christianity in Syria and elsewhere. In fact, early Christianity was very much known for emphasis upon healing, upon Christ's presence, about miracles. That's contemporary Christianity around the world, other than in the West. So I think it's the Christian story. I think in terms of, we did a whole session today about a whole session today about the senses and about the body. I don't think you were there on this. It was about 3 hours. And I talked a little bit about the science of how, and my understanding of it from the literature and from other people involved in this field, neurosciences and so on, we're always sensing things around us. my argument is, if we're constantly intaking sounds and perceptions, like, how are we going to deal with that? How are we going to really acknowledge what those are and change them when they need to be changed? It's not as if someone has now become aware of their senses and now sensing. We already are doing it constantly, this second, all the time. So how do we bring those, how do we become more aware of the senses, and how do they become tools to become practices of faith? Look, the practices of seeing and of the practices of smell. Do you use incense at the cathedral? There we go. Right? It's an early, if you could just give me just a... So I think that all these practices are rooted in the life of Christian faith. You could just as much given a talk about the spiritual senses. So I think just becoming aware of this, of the neurosciences and how they acknowledge that how our brains and our bodies and our cells work together, or to understand the world around us, or to shut it out. So I think it's really about that. I think in terms of Christianity, that some of the language you quoted me back was the Apostle Paul. You know, this is what the gospel is doing. It's what it's always been doing. It's not controlled by any theory or any period of time. It is rooted in all of time and cultures. But the story of the Christian faith is from the book of Acts. And it's saying it's not going to be grounded in one culture. It's not going to be just becoming like the Jewish community who were converted. They're going to become Gentiles. And they're going to cross every culture and every language. And Christianity doesn't say that one language or one culture is the sacred or the primary one. They're all blessed and honored by God. And so the multicultural, that's a loaded word, but the Christianity is an intercultural faith. And the ability to not be cross-cultural, to say this is how I'm going to reach you or you're going to reach me, but to be intercultural in conversation, I think is the entire story that we read about of the gospel and the church in Ephesians, for example. And there's one other sort of thing that I wanted to. I've kind of lost track of. You had a number of questions, but I feel like the Christian story is much more dynamic than this, and it's not in our control. It's in God's control. It's the gospel, and to be challenged and shaped by that, and to become part of that story in the most intentional and ways of most integrity that we can, I think is incumbent upon all of us. And to be learners, and oh, here's what I was going to say. Actually, I think this whole idea about the body and the senses, the more I sort of go back into, like, reading Calvin and reading the Reformed tradition, the desire to know others, desires, the abilities that we have, the wonder of our sight, the wonder that the world is still standing and that time goes on and that we age, and we have a soul, we believe. These things are rooted in who we're created to be. That's who we are. And so I think to bring that into right relationship, to order in the right way in relationship to our own, the ways that we've been shaped. The way that we understand how blind we are to a particular perspective often comes by seeing through somebody else's eyes. And I think that is something that Christians do owe one another. We do owe one another the gift of helping one another see things in a new way and hear voices that we haven't heard. And that's the work, I think, of the church, is to give that space to one another. And that is the only way that we can become the body of Christ, is when others help us grow. Paul says, in essence, in Ephesians 2 and 3, that we cannot achieve the full stature of Christ by ourselves, but only with the full body of Christ. And so if there is a gap or a history of sin, the only way we can come to that place of newness is through others who lead us into a new way.
You were cooking there, man. That was great.
Somebody should. That's the last.
Somebody should say, "Come on, keep going." I want to just pick up on this because I think there's something that I just clued into about your theological method. Because Richard raised questions of phenomenology, of postmodernism, perspectivalism, and that there are all these different ways to get at things now. And before we knew it, you were talking about neuroscience. So we threw in another discipline. You talked ethnography. You talked anthropology. And just before you finished, you ended by talking about creation. And I think that one of the reasons, so this is my interpretation of you, having read you and engaged you all these years, I think that your methodological breadth, so that you engage in various kinds of discourses to get at what you want to talk about, is a breadth actually rooted in your understanding of creation, right? It's because of the richness of creation. This, folks, is the reformed side of what's going on here. This richness of a reformed understanding of creation, which then makes it necessary to be hospitable to a multiplicity of perspectives, both in terms of disciplinary perspectives, how do we get at this, how do we try to understand whatever it is we're talking about, but also in terms of a multiplicity of perspectives, different angles, and needing to have this hospitality to hearing through other ears and other voices and other eyes. So, Angela, you got the last word, sister. You. Here you go.
But thank you for your questions on this area. Thank you very much.
And actually, I think you've partly just answered my question.
Good.
Which was going to be, I'm fascinated by your description of the different style of worship in the African church, very Pentecostal, and also your description of the importance of the senses. And I'm wondering, what other factors do you think that we have to learn, that we can learn from the African church, if it's possible to generalize that way? And conversely, is there anything that the African church can learn from the West?
Yeah, that's a simple question.
You should read the last chapter, Word Made Global. So two answers. One answer is sort of to Brian's comment. I should say it's interesting. I didn't actually read anthropology, ethnography after I did all my work. I was trying to figure out ways to write about things. You know, if you want to write about theology, where do you look for? You work for exemplars, right? And what do you pick up? Bart, you pick up systematic theology. How do you learn to write about church life? So you poke around. You read novels. You read all kinds of fields. The senses. I learned about the senses. I thought about that because what we're doing in Queens, in Jackson Heights. So then I thought I might look a little bit at the neurosciences and see how senses really work. So you're kind of just looking at this to try to understand more fully the experience that you're having, and then, of course, rooted in creation. Here's what, there is so much to learn from every church community. I've learned a lot tonight from, I've learned so much from the days in Toronto and from the different experiences and learning together, the practices we did about what is the city, what is ministry, from the questions tonight, from this physical space here and from the hospitality of the cathedral, about what ministry is in a city. And I am changed by this. I think we in the church and in the city, no one has a corner on answers. We're always learning from one another. We always have to be open. And we have to be who we are. We can't change that. I can't change who I am. But that's okay. That's in the providence of God and in my calling to open myself up every morning to the Spirit and see how God will change me this day. I learned about prayer. I learned about asking things in a new way. I learned that I was converted to Christianity in a new way. And I've had other experiences since then. And I think everyone can learn from one another. In our seminary, we studied the history of New York City. History class, we studied the history of New York, and there's an example of how we can all learn. Wherever we are, we want to learn the history of our city because it impacts how we do ministry. So if you're hearing about Toronto and its history of discrimination and relationship to the United States and how that's influenced maybe the geography of Toronto, boy, if you're doing ministry here, you want to learn everything you can about the history of Toronto. And so we all can be learning all the time about our context and our world because it's changing like this. And because it is a world of great wonders.